This is a sermon for the third Sunday in Advent, and the scripture it reflects on is 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 12 to 28. So, it's the third week of Advent, and as some of you might remember, this Advent I've been trying each week to see what our readings might have to say to us about peace, and about what it might mean for us to prepare to celebrate the birth of the Prince of Peace. In the first week, we reflected on peace as the fullness of human flourishing. And last week, we looked at the idea that peace is about participation in God's own nature. Today, we're in a different kind of space. We're right at the end of the first letter to the Thessalonians, and we're not so much dealing today with the big picture or abstract ideas, no matter how inspiring they might be, but looking much more at the down-to-earth practicalities. After 2 weeks of exploring high-level concepts, today it's as if Paul is saying, well, that's all very well, but let's look at what this might mean for us in practice. And he begins with how we relate to our leaders. It's hard to know whether the Thessalonian community had tensions between its elders and leaders and others, but in some ways it would be surprising if it didn't, since that's been pretty consistent through most of the church's history. And although Paul doesn't say it in quite this way here, I think we're being encouraged to consider the middle path between two extremes. On the one extreme, we don't want to undermine our leaders, to make their lives a misery, to make every encounter with them one of conflict. And this is probably close to where Paul's train of thought is running in this letter, where he's asking the people in this church to respect their leaders, to esteem them, and to love them. On the other extreme, though, it's not healthy to put our leaders on a pedestal, to treat everything they say as if it comes from God himself, and to never ever challenge or contradict or disagree with leaders. One of the things I really value about Anglicanism is that at every level our leadership is shared. In the parish it's not just your priest, but it's wardens and parish council and lay readers and so on. At a diocesan and national level it's not just the bishops, but it's the councils and synods. And leadership is shared amongst a group, including clergy and laity. I think that helps us to keep that middle path between the two extremes, because at some level, we all get to participate. My reflection on my own experience would be that one way this matter of healthy relationship with leaders has become more difficult is the generation gap. In many parishes now, and it's certainly true in our own, the parish priest is much younger than most parishioners. And that can mean a gap in ideas, expectations, worldview, and so on, that can bring in tension from both sides of that relationship. On the whole, we navigate it well, but it doesn't hurt us to be aware of it. But Paul also talks about other practical ways the church community pursues peace. By challenging idlers, for example. This is a tricky one. On the one hand, people have a right to choose to be as involved or uninvolved in church as they like, and if someone wants to come to church, worship in the pews, and not get involved beyond that, we can't force that person to do more. But I think Paul's comment here reflects the reality that church is only what we make it, that our life together is only as rich as everyone's willingness to be involved, and that if some people always come along and benefit from everyone else's efforts without ever contributing, well, that is really not entirely fair. And rather than let resentment build about that, he's kind of giving permission here for that person to be approached and encouraged to consider how their gifts and strengths can contribute to the life of the whole. It's not something I'd do lightly or quickly to approach someone else like that, but maybe Paul hoped that some of the people receiving his letter would get the message without needing someone else to say something. But it's not all negative. Paul writes that we should encourage the faint-hearted and help the weak. Sometimes that encouragement can be really simple. I met with someone this week who wanted to come to church for the first time, but was really nervous about what it would be like. So I physically welcomed her into the church building and let her look around, see the place, think about where she might sit and so on, so she could feel safe coming back. It's a small thing, but I hope that she's genuinely encouraged and that we might see her in church. And Paul doesn't unpack what he means here by weak, It could be as simple as making sure our buildings are accessible for people with mobility issues. But the direction of his message here is clear. Part of being a community of peace means supporting and encouraging and building one another up. And that links back to the idea that peace is about the fullness of human flourishing. And then there's that bit about not repaying evil for evil, but always seeking to do good. Perhaps we could rephrase that as being committed to breaking the cycle of dysfunctional relationships. That's not always easy. Sometimes it's very costly. And I might add, no matter how committed to it we are in principle, we are human, and sometimes we get it wrong. But if this is the way of life we understand as foundational to what it means to be a Christian, over time, we're more likely to grow into doing better. These practical instructions from Paul help us to begin to think in concrete, practical ways about peace, about what it means to live together in a way which promotes the fullness of human flourishing, about what it means to relate to others in a way which reflects God's way of relating. They are perhaps deceptively simple at first glance, but I suspect that if we take the time to really ponder them, we will find here enormous depth which can strongly shape our life together in ways which deepen our existence as a community of peace.